Welcome to the Dakota Live Podcast. I am your host, Robert Morier, and we are thrilled to bring you this inaugural episode. If you're not familiar with Dakota and their Dakota Live content, please check out Dakota.com to learn more about their services. Dakota is a multi-solution provider for your fundraising needs. Over the years, Dakota has brought investment salespeople, industry, and marketing expertise to make their jobs easier. Dakota offers comprehensive contact management information for your fundraising efforts, video and marketing production assistance, investment sales training, and more to help scale your business. Dakota connects investment salespeople with leading investment decision makers with their Dakota Live videos, ensuring you always know who to call and how to approach the markets you are targeting. The goal of this podcast is to help you better know the people behind the decisions. You will be introduced to chief investment officers, manager research professionals, senior sales leaders, and other important players in the industry who will help you sell in between the lines to help humanize your sales approach. Before we get started, I need to read a brief disclosure. This content is provided for informational purposes and should not be relied upon as recommendations or advice about investing in securities. All investments involve risk and may lose money. Dakota does not guarantee the accuracy of any of the information provided by the speaker who is not affiliated with Dakota. Not a solicitation, testimonial, or an endorsement by Dakota or its affiliates. Nothing herein is intended to indicate approval, support, or recommendation of the investment advisor or its supervised persons by Dakota. Today's episode is brought to you by Dakota Searches. Are you tired of endlessly scrolling through investment publications, trying to stay on top of the latest investment mandate opportunities? Look no further than Dakota Searches. With Dakota Searches, you'll never miss a new mandate again. Our powerful platform sends you email alerts as soon as new searches are posted, so you can be one of the first to know. Subscribe today for a 30-day free trial and experience the convenience and efficiency of Dakota Searches. And for even more benefits, become a Dakota Marketplace member for full access to Dakota Searches, our institutional investor database Dakota Marketplace, and more. Sign up for Dakota Searches and stay ahead of the game. Visit our website at dakota.com/dakota-searches to learn more and start your free trial today. Before we begin, I want to quickly introduce myself. After more than two decades of focusing exclusively on business development and investor relations with institutional and retail investors globally, I came home to Philadelphia to co-found a media company focusing on podcast production. I can also be found at Drexel University as a professor in the Close School of Entrepreneurship and a social entrepreneur in residence, mentoring and teaching the next generation of founders. Over more than 20 years, I've headed institutional sales team for three growing asset managers. I've launched a London-based subsidiary for a publicly traded company, managed over 600 institutional clients and consultants, while raising billions of dollars in assets under management across traditional and alternative strategies. I've also served as an advisory board member for the University of Vermont Grossman School of Business, and I still assist asset managers with fundraising strategy, and I'm excited to be hosting the Dakota Live podcast. So thank you for being here. And Floyd and Andrew, thank you for being here with me.
Of course.
Thank you.
So joining me today from Dakota is Andrew O'Shea. You may recognize Andrew from Dakota Live, the videos that are airing every Friday, if I remember that correctly.
Yes.
Good. So thank you so much. He joined Dakota nearly a decade ago. Andrew is focused on business development and raising capital in the RIA, multifamily office, bank, consultant, and endowment foundation channels on behalf of Dakota partner clients. That's a lot of channels.
It is.
How do you keep it all together?
They're all unique. They each have their own challenges and needs based on the types of investors. And our job is to make sure we're constantly adding value based on what their needs are.
Those needs must be changing, I would assume, just given everything that's been happening more recently in the market.
Yes. They always are changing, but I would say more so of late. You know, certainly with market volatility comes opportunity and portfolios. And so we're certainly seeing activity pick up across all channels, which is exciting. But it's a big task to stay in front of and always understand, you know, what's most topical based on the underlying allocator.
So traveling is picking up or slowing down?
Traveling is picking up for the first time, I think, consistently post-COVID. I was in San Francisco last week. Was in Baltimore 2 weeks ago. So excited to be out seeing allocators, seeing our portfolio managers, getting back on the road. Zoom's been great, but you just can't beat those face-to-face interactions, as I'm sure Floyd knows.
That's great. Well, good. Well, we're happy to have you here in Philadelphia. So thank you for being here.
Of course.
And last but not least, Mr. Floyd Simpson. Floyd, thank you for joining us.
No
Floyd,
problem.
I'm going to give a quick background on you, and then we'll fill in the between the lines over the next 25 minutes or so. Does that sound okay?
That works.
Good. All right. Thanks. Stop me if there's anything you want to add or any flourish you want
No. I don't think so. Okay.
Well, Floyd Simpson joined PFM Asset Management in 2019 and was the first external hire for the newly created Multi-Asset Strategies Group. In his current role, he works with institutional clients to develop and implement multi-asset strategies for their portfolios. You author thought leadership pieces, and you are a voting member of the outsourced CIO Investment Committee, which has oversight of $16.7 billion in assets under management as of the end of June. Prior to joining PFM, Floyd was an investment officer at Exponence here in Philadelphia, responsible for emerging manager research and portfolio management of global and international equity strategies. You went to Truman University, where you got your BA, and you have an MBA from DePaul University, and you're also a CFA charter holder.
Yes.
It's a lot of acronyms.
Yes. I guess when you have to look at all these strategies, you need to be able to understand them to a deeper level.
That's good. Well, we appreciate it. And let me just give a quick background on PFM. PFM Asset Management partners with public sector, nonprofit, and other institutions to build tailored, flexible investment solutions across fixed income and multi-asset strategies. They have an OCIO group, which you're responsible for as part of their team. And you work with organizations across the nation, rather, with more than $189 billion in total AUM. That is quite a load.
It is. It is. And I think, a lot of times, a lot of people don't realize how many assets under management we do have, but we have a lot.
Yeah, and you have a new owner, is that right?
Yes. As of December of last year, we are a wholly owned subsidiary of U.S. Bank.
Okay. Well, I won't ask you how that's going on the podcast. So otherwise, we might have to edit it out. But
It's good.
Good. I'm happy to hear. Yes, well, we've been seeing each other more often recently. You came into my classroom. I teach at Drexel University Venture Investments. And you were speaking to students about your background and, how you came into the role that you are currently. But you do a lot of work with students. I think at Temple University as well. What's been the drive for you working with students and trying to give back to your alma mater and other areas?
I look at it and I say, very big within Exponence, you had to build a pipeline. And I think you had to build a pipeline that would really be sustainable and could flourish. And one of the ways within investments that we build a pipeline is by working with individuals at schools. And I do think that, a lot of times from our industry, we don't always have a lot of interaction within the schools. And I remember when I was at Truman State, I didn't see a lot of people that look like me in the investment industry or have anybody in the investment industry really sit down and talk to me. And so I felt like, if I'm in this position, I can be able to change that. And also when I take a step back by working with the students, I really get an understanding of what are some of the things that they're looking at? What are some of the things that are pushing them? What are some of the trends that we should be looking at and I should be aware of in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, I'm not into TikTok or anything, but if I think about how big some of the students are in TikTok, what are they looking at? What are they consuming? What are they wearing? Those are things that give me an idea of what are some of the things I should be looking at on not just for today, but for tomorrow.
All right. So how much of your time is on TikTok during the day?
zero, unfortunately.
That's good. But you are still working with Truman State. So you're part of their investment committee as well?
So actually with Truman State, no longer. Okay. I was part of their foundation committee and I just rolled off at the middle of last year and ended up joining the board of trustees for A.T. Steele University based off the work from Truman State University.
So what's that like being on that side of the table? You've been on the asset management side, the asset allocator side for a long time. How is it to see what the other side sees?
To me, it was enlightening. And it was enlightening from two perspectives. One, being cognizant of the information that's being given to us. A lot of times in our positions, we're used to having the informational advantage and giving that information. But when I sat on that foundation committee, looking at the investments, really focusing in on what's going on, not at just a tactical level, but also a strategic asset allocation, it made me realize that, there's a lot of things lacking sometimes within that seat. And, if I think about some of the things that we've been able to do at PFM, I really had a really good view of what's effective governance for boards. Also, what's the value of having, the difference of a consulting relationship versus an OCIO relationship. Also, what is the true value and what do schools, and, you know, at that point in time when we were doing a search and going out to bid for Truman State University's foundation, you know, what is the true need for the university? How is that going to impact the university, not just for the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, but the next 10 years, 15, 20, 30 years? How does this relationship actually help the students? And I think that's the one thing I also learned too. And sitting on that side was, you know, I thought about the foundation, but I also thought about what does this mean for the school and what does this mean for the students and the interactions that they would gain? And I do think because of that, that allowed me to really hone in and take a note of I need to be more present within, within that academic realm.
How would you characterize that difference in relationships as you've seen yourself on the consulting side back when Exponents was FIS Group versus the OCIO side? What are, from your perspective, some of the key characteristics, the key differences between a consultant relationship and an OCIO relationship? And I guess maybe we can, if you wouldn't mind, Andrew, after that, be curious, you know, how would you approach as a salesperson those two relationships if there are any differences in terms of sales approach?
I think, you know, when I think about the consulting versus discretionary, I'm going to take it back to, you know, sitting in a manager research seat. And I do feel that the biggest difference is, you know, with the OCIO, you're discretionary. You're making the decisions. In some respects, you know, you do have to have a very good understanding of not just buy aspects, but also when to sell, risk management. I do think, you know, when you're in the consulting seat, you're more giving the information to the client. You have to think about you have to think about the messaging. But, you know, I do think a lot of times within consulting, you know, it is about supplying clients with choices and saying, okay, let me give you a good breadth of choices. And I do think as the OCIO sometimes, you know, that's where it's like, okay, well, this is what I do on a consistent basis. And this allows me to go in and make this decision. And it's a little bit faster. I think sometimes, you know, with, you know, when you're, you know, in that consulting relationship, you can give the information out. You can give your views, but you know, the decision-making time frame gets lengthened. And that can be the difference between, you know, a couple basis points to 100 to 1,000 basis points.
How about the approach, Andrew? Do you find it's any different between going to a consultant, and Floyd touches on, you know, maybe the speed of decision-making? Anything else that you've kind of picked up on over the last decade?
I think more specifically on the consulting side, you really need to understand, you know, as an institutional consultant, what are their underlying clients? What's the profile of their underlying clients, whether it's foundation and endowment or, you know, family office or retirement plans, because at the end of the day, that can help guide where their investment decision-making will be and what the type of profile of managers they want. But in most cases, you're going to have to embrace a very long sales cycle. In most cases, it's getting to an approved or recommended list status. And then, you know, simply getting on the approved list doesn't mean that money just pours in. And so you always have to be constantly engaging with that consultant, but also their underlying field consultants, which manage the relationships with the underlying plans or institutions. So with the consulting side, to Floyd's point, you know, as a salesperson, you really have to embrace the long sales cycle. Whereas on the OCIO side, we've seen historically, they've been willing to be earlier adopters of investment strategies. So smaller AUM base, smaller track record. They can tolerate more tracking error from managers in their portfolio. So the OCIO channel has been growing tremendously. But I think for younger, smaller managers out there, that represents an important channel in terms of getting out and telling your story, because they can be early adopters of your strategy.
So Floyd, you've worked with emerging managers before.
Yes.
At Exponents. And Andrew raises some great points, you know, in terms of an OCIO maybe taking an earlier look at a manager, partly because they may need, the OCIO may need to distinguish themselves relative to a much larger peer group.
Right.
But those emerging managers have a lot of other hurdles to get over. What are some of the key attributes that you saw in a successful emerging manager?
You know, when I take a step back and think about the successful traits of an emerging manager, I think the biggest thing was having a long-term view. Also, you know, understanding that when I have that first meeting, the first meeting does not mean that I'm going to have dollars come in like tomorrow. And it was really more.
It doesn't. That's why I'm teaching.
And so, you know, with that, you know, it was more of, okay, let me sit back, talk to you about my process. Why does it make sense? Where does it come from? Really spend time honing in on those details. Also the fact that, because, you know, this business does require a lot of, you know, you have to have a lot of capital. And, you know, I do think that, you know, those that were successful, you know, plan to say, okay, hey, I might not be able to raise a single dollar for the next 5 years. Can I run my business and maintain my lifestyle that I currently have with knowing that in advance? That was also key. You know, I would also say when I think about, you know, what people did in advance, a lot of people actually sat down that were successful, sat down with myself and others to kind of feel, okay, well, what are you looking at? What makes sense to you? When I'm coming up with this business, so here's the thing, when I'm coming up with the business, not when I've done it, but when I'm coming up with the business, does, you know, is this something that you feel will be successful in the long term? Instead of, you know, a lot of times you just see people and it says F's after they launched, but really more finding the people before launching and saying, okay, I want to do this. What are some of the hurdles? Having good people around them. And when I say good people that, A, number one, really understand their roles, understand the value that they bring. Along with that, you know, very cost conscious. I don't think that, you know, you need to have everything, you know, when I was in that seat, you didn't need to have everything in-house on day one, but keeping things in-house that really did matter, that was one of the biggest keys within there. And then, you know, understanding the risk management. Mm. You know, I think the risk management key, whether it's on, you know, whatever we end up doing, risk management, in my view, can either help make a firm or it can break a firm.
I've seen risk management both on the desk and then off the desk, you know, in terms of how risk is managed across a portfolio process. Do you have a preference? Do you prefer having an external risk management process where there's a chief risk officer who maybe reports into a COO or a CIO rather than the portfolio manager? Or do you like the portfolio manager really having ownership of that risk management process? I think as an emerging manager, that is one of the questions we've heard over the years, is how to develop that risk management process where it's relatable to an allocator.
I think it's, you know, it's checks and balances. So when I think about the risk management process, I would say, you know, as an emerging manager, you're not going to have 100 people. So you'll probably have people doing dual roles. I would say, one of the best things that I saw when I was sitting in that seat was, okay, if the trading team was inputting the trades, the compliance team was actually doing the coding within Bloomberg and or the other trade system, and checking that. And so I looked at that and said, that was a form of, okay, the trading team, the portfolio management team is doing one portion. Compliance is getting involved in setting the parameters within that and monitoring the parameters within that. And I saw that was a very good way of being able to kind of get that risk management aspect, getting that compliance officer involved, but the compliance officer also being a step away. And really more, especially within that, not having the compliance officer flow into the CIO, having them be a separate, you know, having that person be a separate person, a separate group if possible, that either reports directly, you know, then to the board or advisors and to the president/CEO.
That's interesting. Thanks. So with PFM, taking a step away from the emerging manager, you're in a much more mature manager now, but you were the first hire on that team. What has that been like, building out a new team?
It's been very interesting because, you know, when I stepped into this role, we had an idea of what it would look like. But I took the role in 2019, October 2019. So you just think October 2019, you take a role.
Everybody was healthy.
Everybody was healthy. Then all of a sudden, March of 2020, you know, everything stops. And you really have to, you know, and for myself, I had to redefine like, okay, well, here's what I thought the role was going to be. Here's my skill set. And what do I think are some of the things that I can work on during this, you know, during that time period to be able to quote unquote add value to the firm going forward. And I do think that, you know, as crazy as the 2020 time period was, that really gave me a chance to meet with a lot of my coworkers, you know, and I did it virtually, but spend some time with my coworkers, really spend some time with the business, understanding what the business needed and within my seat, how can I pivot and help the business. Also, you know, how are we doing business? You know, are there different ways to do business? And I think, you know, with that time, that allowed me to really have open my eyes and say, okay, well, here's the channels that we're consistently focusing on. Here's a channel that we haven't focused on. Here's a person that I work with that really wants to focus on that channel. How can I help support this person? Because I think, you know, in my role is about supporting, making sure that, you know, that everybody in the field has what they need, making sure that, you know, the information, the communication goes out in a timely fashion, but also, you know, is accurate. You know, and so when I think about that type of role, when somebody says, hey, you know, I see this avenue, it could possibly bring in some assets for us. And we think that this might be a good look for PFM going forward. I have to listen. I think that's the one thing within COVID, especially even within this position that that I've had to be a lot more flexible. And I really had to take a step back and be able to look at the whole business.
That's interesting.
And it's been good.
You referenced channels there. What's been the historical client base of PFM and where is it growing?
Yeah. So you actually pointed right to where the growth has been. And historically, you know, if you think of PFM, especially PFM asset management, public financial management, public governance. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about cash management and how that, you know, how PFM was built, we started with public funds and governments and municipalities. If I look and say, okay, where's the growth rate? We've seen a lot of growth in the E&F sector. Mm-hmm. So we saw a lot of growth in the E&F sector. Also, you know, we've seen, you know, a lot of growth in the OCI, you know, OCIO consultant aspect. You know, I think those are two areas that we've really seen a lot of growth. And, you know, I think that have really allowed us to, you know, be a lot more creative mm-hmm. with our process and how we construct portfolios.
I'm curious, when you started with PFM, Andrew, I can certainly attest to this, particularly among consultants, there's been a lot of movement. We've had a lot of people moving, organizations, manager research, you know, people going from firm A to firm B. And one of the challenges I know of salespeople and Dakota Marketplace manages as well in terms of keeping track of where people are going, but what they're bringing with them. So when you think about when you left your prior firm and came to PFM, are you bringing a roster, a stable of asset managers that you know that you're going to want to incorporate into the PFM model? And then when you are introduced to a new model, how do you go about thinking kind of who stays and who goes?
You know, the biggest thing I had to learn about how does PFM look at portfolios? How does PFM look at the world? Then from there, which, you know, in my view, hey, you know, which managers really fit based off of, you know, how PFM manages money. And, you know, and then to my view, you know, that was, okay, you know what? I think these type of managers would fit. And, you know, I want to make sure that these managers get introductions. So that's been one of my biggest things, which is making sure from day one, making sure that, you know, if there's managers that should be on their radar, that they're on their radar, that they're on the research team's radar. Also, if there's managers that I know and have worked with in the past that I do think, hey, you know what, based off the way that they manage money, this might be a really good fit for us. But, you know, they might be sick, you know, they might not have had somebody look at them recently, be able to, you know, ask research, hey, can you look at this person based off of some of the things that they've done and changed? They might be, you know, this might be something that we might be really interested in. Also, I do think because, when I was with Exponence, I really worked a lot with equities. By moving over to a multi-assets aspect, it's allowed me to broaden my horizon. So, I've actually dealt a lot more with a lot of the fixed income managers, but also the alternative managers. So a lot of the managers that I actually knew from my Exponence days, but sometimes they would have strategies that could be portable into some type of equities model, but sometimes could not. Those are managers now that I'm like, hey, you know what? Let me make sure that, our team is aware of them. Let me make sure that they know who to talk to, and also make sure that, they are getting, people are spending time with them and are giving them a genuine look. I think for me, that's what I've been able to do. And as you can tell, even within who comes and who goes, it's been less of that. And it's really been more of who fits. To answer to your point that you're talking about, really understanding who you're marketing to. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's more of understanding of, okay, hey, I know you from this aspect, but does this really fit based off of how PFM manages money, the PFM model, the way we look at managers? Mm-hmm. So I think, that's where that aspect, in my view, I've been able to bring over and port. But, it's not something that I would probably say you can rinse and repeat all the time. You really have to look at the situation and say, does it fit?
Could you take us inside the process at PFM from the point of you have a manager meeting, you start due diligence, you go through that entire underwriting process, but what should the expectations of a manager be? Is it an approved list? Is it a rating? Are you eligible then to be in searches for your underlying clients?
So we actually, at PFM, we do searches from scratch. So it's based mm-hmm. off of, what are we looking at the current time? Do we need to make a replacement? And at that junction in time, if we feel we might need to do a replacement or we might want to add something, that's when we're really doing a search. So within that search process, and I think the key question with meeting with whether it's myself or anybody that's on the manager research team is, do you have an active search for this? Mm-hmm. That's the really key question. Do you have an active search? If not, do you think that do you know if you're going to be doing an active search for this? If so, when? Those are, in my view, the two key questions. Mm-hmm. Because, for us, we don't have, I would probably say a rating system. We're not, we do, rate managers once we fund managers, but, for every manager that we're really looking at, we're doing it search by search based off of what we truly need. So, we're not holding somebody and saying, hey, we rated this manager and they're still on our buy list, approve list. No, if we have somebody there, we're funded with them. So it's a little bit different than your traditional consulting.
That's great. And have there been any consistent themes in terms of the searches you've been seeing on behalf of clients by asset class?
For us, because we do the searches ourselves because we have discretionary, there hasn't been a true theme overall. If I think about it for the past, past couple of years, we've looked at, international small cap. Mm-hmm. I'd probably say, we spent a lot of time building out, our alternatives model. Those are probably some of the searches that you've probably seen from us, whether it's been private equity, private debt, private real assets. Now, I think, I already said we've done, international small cap. Outside of that, I think, we haven't really done a ton of searches in regards to, I think what some people would consider like a significant search activity. We're really more of a buy and hold. I do remember the one of the last ones we have done, we've done on the high yield side also, and we also did mid cap. Mm-hmm.
So you've talked about some of the must-haves that asset managers should approach you with. We talked about risk management, just thinking about how you manage your process of consistency. What are some of the must-nots that asset managers should be focusing away from. And we off camera before we got started, we talked about leading with performance. That, you know, that tends to be one of the three P's that a lot of asset managers focus on: people, process, performance. But from your perspective, you know, what are some of the pitfalls that asset managers can avoid as they're introducing, you know, their product to you maybe for the first time?
When I sat in manager research, the leading with performance was the one thing that just got under my skin completely. Because, you know, I knew performance, you know, ebbs and flows. Because if you're selling performance, that's not going to, that's automatically going to stop the conversation. Because I'm like, okay, well, you're just selling performance. I would say other red flags that I saw, you know, in that seat were going into the meeting and just going on autopilot, having a script and just saying, here's my script, I'm sticking to this, and set go. And then all of a sudden, an hour later, any questions?
I guess that goes into what you said before, like you're looking for a fit.
Right.
Right. So in order to fit into something, your story or your script might not fit exactly into that solution that you're looking for. So being a little bit more flexible in the conversation when they're presenting their product to you.
Yes. I think, you know, when I was definitely doing it on a consistent basis, one of the things that I traditionally would go in and make sure I knew managers knew was, let's talk about what you have, but also let me educate you on how we do things here. And a lot of times some people would take a step back and say, okay, let me listen and adjust. But a lot of times they actually wouldn't adjust and they just listen and just say, okay, well, here's what I do. And this is, and you should hire me. And when are you going to give me assets? when are you going to give me assets? Or another red flag is, you know, if I ask a question about where certain things in the process came from, and either they wouldn't answer it, they would say, well, you know, this is proprietary, and certain things that are proprietary, I 100% agree. But certain things, there is a fundamental basis of where it came from. And explaining that fundamental basis, I feel a lot of times helped me understand the process a lot better. But if I felt that somebody couldn't articulate that consistently, that was always a red flag.
You know, time and again, regardless of the asset class, whether it's venture or public equities, we always hear from consultants and allocators that people are the most important part of the process. It's really understanding who the people are, how they think, how decisions are made. But I always find that that's probably the hardest part to get to understand, right? So how do you get to know somebody, understanding or feeling comfortable, trusting them with hundreds of millions of dollars of your assets? How does that process work for you and work for PFM? How do you think about character and defining character in the context of a manager selection process and partnership process?
Well, I think that's where the on-site comes into play. You really need to be able to sit down, not just with the two people that you're consistently on. And because of the past couple of years, consistently on Zoom or Microsoft Teams with, you really need to go in, meet the analysts, spend time with them, and spend time with them, not with the portfolio manager or the salesperson in the room, but just spend time with them by themselves. Look at spend time with them on the desk, how they look at things. Walk through the analysis of a stock with them, and really spend time to also get to know them, not as just the investment professional, but as the person too. Because you can't divorce the two. And you know within the investment decision-making process that, yes, you have a process, but there are behavioral biases. And understanding those behavioral biases of the individuals going into that really does help you out. And in my view, from the on-sites, it did. And I think, you know, within, you know, PFM, you know, when, you know, our manager research team is on-site, they're doing that exact same thing. You know, they're sitting down, you know, talking with the various team members, talking with the individuals one-on-one, walking through scenarios with them, you know, trying to understand, like, you know, for instance, if you have a portfolio manager, you have a large analyst team. What happens when, you know, an analyst that has done fairly well before really starts to struggle? Like, how do you work with them? Walk me through that. Give me an example. What are some of the steps that you have done? I think, you know, those are things that, you know, I know our team sits down and does and has asked from managers. And, you know, I think that those are some of the things that, you know, are the keys to success.
So that in-person dynamic.
It always is.
So are you back on the conference circuit then?
Yes, I'm back on the conference circuit. Like Andrew's, it's definitely been a lot of travel. My travel probably picked up starting last year. But, you know, the conference circuit seems like it's been, it's come back to life. So I've been to a fair amount of places.
Okay. So your behavioral biases, I assume, take you to Chicago often?
Yeah, surprisingly not, unfortunately. Surprisingly not.
Austin, is that where?
Yes. I might, some behavioral biases will take me to Austin. Mm-hmm. You'll be surprised. I think I would expect to be in New York a lot more. Based off of, you know, when you think about investment managers, even just investments as a whole. But I haven't really done a lot of conferences in New York. It's been really spread out. And it hasn't been centralized in one location either, which I find very interesting and good, because, you know, I'm able to meet a lot of different people that I would have never met.
Well, unless Andrew has any more questions, I just have one more for you. As you're thinking about asset managers calling you, trying to get more information, maybe hearing something that resonated with them from this podcast, which again, thank you so much for joining us for this First Dakota Studios Live podcast. What's the best way to, you know, to get in touch with you other than find you at a conference
or other than find me at a conference,
a Bears game,
a Bears game, or, you know, it's Eagles. I'm here in Philadelphia. And Eagles are 6-0. You know, team looks really good. Oh my gosh. In the NFC East. But, you know, I digress. If trying to find me, email, SimpsonF@pfmam.com. And, you know, I usually tell people, I'm like, I do travel, so, you know, just be cognizant. If I don't always respond within a day or two, feel free to send a follow-up email. I don't take it personally.
No, good stuff. Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for sharing your email address. I think you're going to regret that. No, but Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on this first podcast as well, and working with Dakota. This is a great opportunity. We hope for listeners to get a little bit of a deeper dive in terms of people like yourself, Floyd. And we're looking forward to more episodes. So you'll be able to find this episode on Dakota's website, which is dakota.com. You'll see Andrew and Floyd on the conference circuit over the course of the fall. So look for both of them, I'm sure. Yes. If you want to listen to this episode or past episodes, again, those will be available on dakota.com as well as on your favorite podcast platforms, whether that's Spotify, Apple, and we are on video. So this will be on YouTube as well. So yes, please check us out. And we want to thank Floyd Simpson from PFM for joining us today. Andrew from Dakota for being here as well. Thank you for your questions. And we'll say goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Floyd.
Thank you.
Goodbye.